Good evening.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's really sweet.
My name is Sergio Ginja, and I'm here to welcome you to McGill. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue à McGill et à cette soirée au nom de la faculté de droit de son doyen Daniel Jutras, ainsi qu'au nom de l'équipe de recherche Justice privée et État de droit. It gives me great pleasure to introduce this lecture, which has become such an important event in the intellectual life of our faculty. Our faculty, as you will have noticed, has now thoroughly embraced the study of arbitration and private justice more generally as an institutional priority. By doing so, it has given life to what John Brierley would most likely have considered a dream when he completed his doctoral studies in Paris by defending a thesis on arbitration. This was in 1964, and René David was chairing the examination committee. He went on to work with René David, as you know, on this very important book of comparative law, Legal Systems of the World Today. Our faculty investment, and indeed our alumni's investment in this area of study is brilliantly illustrated by the creation of the Fortier Chair and by the appointment of its first incumbent, Professor Andrea Bjorklund. I will invite her to introduce our speaker tonight. Mais avant de ce faire, je voudrais souligner que cette conférence commémorative est le fruit d'une initiative conjointe de la Faculté de droit et de la section internationale pour le Québec de l'Association du barreau canadien. Je salue au passage le président de la section internationale, M. le professeur Alain Pruginaire, qui est un ancien conférencier Brierley et qui est des nôtres ce soir. Je salue également mes collègues, les professeurs Frédéric Bachand et Geneviève Saumier, qui étaient présents aux premières heures de cette initiative. Geneviève Saumier animera la période de questions après la conférence. The lecture, as is pointed out on the program, is made possible by the John E. C. Brierley Memorial Lecture Fund, which was generously established by Maître Yves Fortier. I also want to recognize Mr. James Woods, who year after year generously supports this lecture by hosting the post-conference reception. He is here tonight with the head of arbitration in his firm, Maître Stephen Drimer, and the Honorable Joseph Nuss, who I also want to recognize. I thank all of you for your extraordinary support over the years for this wonderful event. I would like finally to recognize John Brierley's son, Tim Brierley, who is with us tonight. Welcome home, Tim. He's right here. It's always wonderful to have members of the family at this event. But you're all eager to hear our speaker, and I don't want to postpone this for too long. Je vous souhaite donc une excellente soirée, and I now invite Andrea Bjorklund to introduce our speaker. Andrea.
Thank you. Thank you, Fabia, for giving me the privilege of introducing Gary, for giving me a little bit of time in which to do so. It's a real honor to be able to introduce him. As many of you will know, Gary is a partner at WilmerHale in London and in Berlin. He went to college and law school in the United States. He received his first degree in history and religion from Haverford College, one of the finest small liberal arts colleges in the United States, and he then went on to law school at the University of Pennsylvania. He graduated summa cum laude from both of these institutions. Gary then clerked for the legendary Judge Henry Friendly on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and then clerked for Justice Rehnquist of the U.S. Supreme Court. Judge Friendly is one of those judges who is usually talked about as having been, ought to have been on the Supreme Court. You could say that Gary had two Supreme Court clerkships. To those of you who work in international commercial arbitration, Gary really needs no introduction. We all know his treatise on international commercial arbitration, forthcoming soon in a new edition, which is an indispensable handbook renowned for its breadth of coverage and its depth of understanding. Gary has also written a casebook for use in an international commercial arbitration course, and I, for one, am prepared to say that it has eclipsed the rest of the field by a wide margin. Any U.S. lawyer practicing transnational law will also know Gary's treatise on international civil litigation in U.S. courts, which has now been succeeded by a textbook that he wrote with Beau Rutledge from the University of Georgia on the same topic. This, too, is a rich trove of practitioner-related insight and thoughtful scholarly assessment of the challenges involved in litigating international disputes in U.S. courts. Gary has also written numerous other articles, but merely noting the existence of these articles and of his books does not adequately do justice to their quality and their impact. His International Commercial Arbitration Treatise received a Certificate of Merit from the American Society of International Law and accolades from professors and practitioners around the world. Gary's work is very much in keeping with McGill's trans-systemic tradition, as is noted by some of the critical accolades his work received. Many note his ability to look at both the common and civil law traditions. A quote, "A brilliant in-depth academic textbook and a truly international study on arbitration, excellently combining the common law approach with the civilian tradition." Another quote, "The work magnificently manages to set out the core principles of both the Anglo-American common law system of arbitration practices as well as major civil law jurisdictions. In doing so, it provides a splendid comparative law perspective as to the treatment of procedural and practical problems that tend to recur in international arbitrations." Gary's treatises and his textbooks both have stunningly erudite and thoughtful questions following each section. In fact, Gary's questions and comments could serve as the outlines for dozens of research agendas. So those of you who are aspiring academics in the audience who seek topics for your theses or your doctoral dissertations or even your research agendas, I encourage you to seek topics in the back of Gary's books. You won't be disappointed. Now, it's quite remarkable that Gary has produced these works and established himself as one of the foremost international arbitration scholars in the world while working much more than full-time as counsel and as arbitrator. He is legendary among associates for keeping two teams of them busy, one in London and one in Washington, and working more or less round the clock. Unlike Gary, associates seem to be mere mortals who actually have to sleep. One friend of mine who worked in the DC office of Wilmer told me about the handoff. When the London associates would leave the office to go home to sleep, they would hand their work off to the DC folk, who could put in several more hours before themselves retiring, upon which time the work could be handed back to London. There are rumors that Gary himself set records at Wilmer for the amount of hours that he billed. Gary has been an arbitrator in more than 150 cases, and he's been involved in more than 550 cases as counsel. He's active in both commercial and investment arbitration, and has been involved in many quite remarkable cases. He's worked on several of the largest cases in ICC history. He has represented Eritrea in an ad hoc arbitration against Yemen involving territorial sovereignty and maritime delimitation. He represented Greenpeace in the Rainbow Warrior affair. And in an arbitration that I know was very dear to his heart, the Abeye arbitration, he represented the Sudan People's Liberation Movement against the Republic of Sudan. He's a gifted advocate, and one of the tricks of the trade he advocates is the development of the skill of listening rather than speaking, listening to what arbitrators and judges want to hear and adjusting his presentations accordingly. Some of you may not know that Gary did work for a year as a full-time academic at the University of Arizona School of Law, where he wrote the first draft of at least one of his tomes. He has since taught at numerous schools, including Stanford, Harvard, and St. Gallen in Switzerland. Gary has an adventurous spirit. He hitchhiked for a year across Africa. He is an enthusiastic underwater diver and was recently diving off the coast of Malaysia with another international arbitrator, Bernard Hinoshio. He has two children, Natasha and Jedediah, who grew up in Berlin. You might say that Gary has set an example not only for the profession, but for his family. His daughter did her first degree at Stanford and is now at Harvard Law School, and his son is a student at Haverford. Incidentally, and here I believe she was not following in Gary's footsteps, his daughter appeared in Schloss Einstein when she was a teenager. For those of you not up on German television, this is a very popular educational German TV show for children. Gary is an avid country music fan. I'm told by a reliable source that if you go into his office, you will often find either Dolly Parton or Emmylou Harris playing on the stereo. And he was in Nashville, that cradle of country music, just last week. If I were more clever, I would have worked in a reference to Islands in the Stream when I mentioned the Eritrean arbitration, which involved a dispute over the Dzukar Hanish Islands. But we are very lucky to have him here today, and without more ado, I invite him to come address us on the topic of the law applicable to international arbitration, past, present, and future. Gary.
Well, thank you very much. It's one of those moments when you really do want to just keep listening as opposed to having to start talking. On a serious, and thank you very much, Andrea. That was extremely flattering, too flattering. I'd like, first of all, to thank everybody here at McGill, Fabian, Andrea, Tim Brierley, and your father, for having me here. It's a huge honor to be invited to speak at an institution of this quality, and to deliver a lecture in honor of a man of John Brierley's quality. I'd say that even if his own particular field of expertise, international arbitration among them, hadn't been the same of mine, he was a man of single distinction, and it's truly an honor to be asked to give this lecture, and for that again, I thank you. I'd also like to thank the various sponsors, E40A in particular, for having established the possibility for this lecture. Without him, as without John Brierley, this wouldn't have been possible, and I'm very grateful. Turning to my topic, the title of what I'm going to speak about tonight is International Commercial Arbitration, the Law Governing International Commercial Arbitration Agreements, Past, Present, and Future. And what I'm going to do in particular is to look at the law governing the substantive validity of international arbitration agreements, and I'm going to do it by approaching matters chronologically. I'll look at the past, then I'll turn to more or less the present, defined, as we'll see, somewhat broadly, and then hopefully I'll have time, even though I'm only doing this in English, to address the future. my past and present descriptions will be mostly descriptive. My future description will be principally prescriptive, but hopefully to some extent descriptive, in the sense of, if one's optimistic, prescription can turn into description of what will actually exist. And my essential thesis in looking at the law governing the substantive validity of international arbitration agreements is that we've made a good deal of progress over the last century, the last 100 years or so. There has been a substantial advance in choice of law and also substantive law rules governing international arbitration agreements, assisting parties in achieving the purposes of those agreements, namely creating a neutral, efficient, expert means of resolving their disputes in a single centralized forum. And that, although, as we'll see, historically there were hesitations about, indeed in some cases outright hostility towards that basic objective, contemporary choice of law and substantive rules have gone a long way in effectuating that basic objective. That said, I'll also explain how I think there remains substantial work to be done, how to some extent we're faced with a considerable degree of uncertainty about what law applies, substantive law applies to international arbitration agreements, and how a fair bit of work remains to be done in the future. Although the present's better than the past, the future could be better yet, and that, for the most part, the uncertainties that exist and the weaknesses that exist in contemporary choice of law analysis are problems of our own making, and the tools are at hand in the instruments that we have, in particular the New York Convention and the Institutional Model Law, to remedy the uncertainties and, to some extent, the confusion that currently surrounds the law applicable to international arbitration agreements. With that as the roadmap of where we're going, I'd like to say a few words about why it is we're going there, and also a few words about where we're not going before we start down our chronological path through the past, present, and future. Part of the reason that one talks about the law applicable to international arbitration agreements is because of the separability presumption, the rule that arbitration agreements, the dispute resolution provisions in a contract, in a treaty, are separable from, at least presumptively separable from, the underlying instrument, from the underlying commercial contract, from the underlying treaty. And I won't, and I was struck by a comment that James Brierley reportedly once made. He was asked why he wasn't publishing a treatise on a particular subject, and he, with characteristic modesty, said, "Why should I add a 20-watt light bulb," which of course was impossibly far from the truth, "to an area that is already well illuminated?" And so you'll all be relieved to know that, uncharacteristically, I'm also going to do the same thing with respect to the separability presumption. I'm going to use it as the starting point for my discussion, but I'm not going to further illuminate that doctrine, either why we have it or what the reasons for it are. What I am going to do, though, is to recall for us that because of the separability doctrine, we have a new set of choice of law issues. And as the separability doctrine, the concept that the arbitration agreement was separable from the underlying contract or treaty, gained force in the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, it provoked a new set of choice of law questions. If that agreement is a separate agreement, then what law governs it? One had to address that question instead of simply applying the law that would govern the underlying contract. And in a sense, it is that recognition, the recognition resulting from the separability doctrine, that provides the starting point for the inquiry that my talk addresses. I should say immediately, though, as I indicated in the summary of my thesis, that I'm only going to address some of the choice of law issues that follow on from the separability presumption. And I'm going to, in particular, look at the substantive validity of the arbitration agreement. What that means I'm not going to do, firstly, is look at the law governing the arbitral proceedings, the so-called procedural law of the arbitration, curia law of the arbitration. It's a separate topic and one that deserves a separate lecture all of its own. I'm also going to focus on international commercial arbitration agreements as distinct from investment arbitration agreements, investor-state arbitration agreements, and state-to-state agreements in public international law instruments. Much of what I say, or at least some of what I say, has relevance to those inquiries, but my focus will be on international commercial arbitration agreements. And finally, focusing on international commercial arbitration agreements, I'm going to be concerned principally with the substantive validity of those agreements. I'm not going to spend much time discussing issues of formal validity. I'm not going to spend time discussing issues of capacity. And I'm not going to spend time discussing questions of non-arbitrability, so-called disputes not capable of settlement by arbitration. I will come back at the conclusion of my remarks and say a few words about each of those subjects because I think, as I mentioned, my main thesis does have some relevance to thinking in those fields, but that won't be the principal focus of my discussion. Instead, what I'd like to do, turning to the past, is look specifically at the law governing the substantive validity of international commercial arbitration agreements. And the past, and it's easy standing in the present to do this, one often has the tendency to stand on the shoulders of one's forebears, but the past was not such a good place for international commercial arbitration agreements. Many states had anti-arbitration rules, substantive rules of various sorts, either outright rules of invalidity or requirements which made such agreements essentially impracticable, requirements that the arbitrators be named specifically in the agreement to arbitrate, requirements that the dispute be described with particularity in the agreement to arbitrate, which made agreements to arbitrate future disputes extremely rare and difficult to enforce. At the same time, choice of law rules at this time, and by this time I mean late 19th century, early 20th century, prior to the Geneva Protocol and events that I'll discuss in a moment, choice of law rules at this time took the view that the law of the judicial enforcement forum was the law governing the substantive validity of the arbitration agreement. That means if you wish to enforce an arbitration agreement by precluding litigation in, for example, State A, then State A's laws would apply. And the same would be true if one sought to do that in State B. State B's rules would apply on the theory that the arbitration agreement had its effect, and the focus at that point, perhaps because of skepticism and hostility towards arbitration agreements, the focus was on the negative effects of arbitration agreements, their effect in precluding litigation, as opposed to their positive effect of committing the parties to arbitrate in good faith. And so it was said that the proper approach was to look to the law governing remedies, and the remedy was that of the forum where the arbitration agreement had its negative effects. Now, this choice of law rule was not particularly satisfactory. Indeed, it was quite unsatisfactory in the sense that it meant that there were necessarily as many laws, substantive laws, governing the arbitration agreement as there were forums where one might wish to sue. It produced no uniformity in results. It necessarily produced a multiplicity of different substantive rules. And combined with the attitude of the time, the judicial attitude of the time, legislative attitude for the most part as well, which had adopted anti-arbitration substantive rules, this for the most part reinforced the general unenforceability of international commercial arbitration agreements. And that was the past, an unsatisfactory past that used a rule applying the law of the judicial enforcement forum. The present, is somewhat better. The present, as I mentioned, isn't perfect, but it's better. And the present, to understand the present, one needs to start, I think, there are lots of places one could start and lots of things one could address, but one needs to consider two instruments in particular. One needs to consider the 1958 Convention on the Recognition and Enforcement of Foreign Arbitral Awards, the so-called New York Convention, and one needs to consider the UNCTAD Model Law on International Commercial Arbitration, 1985, first proposed. And both of these instruments have been remarkable successes. The New York Convention took a while to get underway, but today it has 149 contracting parties. The UNCTAD Model Law has been adopted by 100 jurisdictions or so. I fudged slightly by referring to jurisdictions because that includes, for example, Canadian provinces and U.S. states and various bits of Australia. But even looking at nation states more broadly, it has well over 50 adoptees. And the reason to focus on these two instruments is because they provide the backdrop for the present approach to the choice of law governing international commercial arbitration agreements. And they do that, and I'll start with the New York Convention and then just refer by reference to the model law. They do that in two places. Article 2 of the New York Convention provides in Article 2.1 that contracting states will recognize agreements to arbitrate, save where they concern matters that are not capable of settlement by arbitration. And Article 2.3 then requires courts in contracting states to refer the parties to arbitration unless those arbitration agreements, are null and void, inoperable, or incapable of being performed. Notably, Article 2 doesn't have in it any particular choice of law rule. It has in it several international standards. Article 2.1's requirement to recognize arbitration agreements, Article 2.3's requirement to refer parties to arbitration. But it doesn't address what national law, if any, ought to be applied in those circumstances. Article 5 of the New York Convention, which deals not with arbitration agreements, like Article 2, but rather with the recognition of foreign arbitral awards, does have, oddly, a choice of law rule with regard to international arbitration agreements. That choice of law rule in Article 5.1a first has a little bit having to do with capacity, which I promised I wouldn't talk about, and then a bit having to do with the substantive law governing the arbitration agreement, providing that an award shall be recognized unless it is not valid under the law to which the parties subjected it, or failing any indication thereon, the law of the place where the award was made. And so, in sum, a two-part choice of law rule in Article 5.1a. Firstly, the law chosen by the parties, the law to which the parties have subjected it. And secondly, a default rule, the law of the so-called arbitral seat or place of arbitration, the place where the award was made. The UNCTAD Model Law essentially tracks that. Article 8.1 is, for all intents and purposes, identical to Article 2 of the Convention. Article 34.2.1a, essentially identical to, in the annulment context, Article 5.1a, Article 36.1a.1, identical in the recognition context. Now, there's been, and this begins to move from a description of the present to an assessment of the present, there's been substantial uncertainty about what exactly the relationship between Article 2 and Article 5 is. Some commentators, some courts, have concluded that Article 2, in fact, doesn't state any choice of law rule at all, that the Article 5 choice of law rule applies to awards in the recognition context, but not to agreements. And therefore, states are free in determining whether an arbitration agreement is null and void, inoperable, or incapable of being performed, free to apply their own choice of law rules. And they've done so. Other countries, other states, other other commentators have argued that one needs to view the convention systematically. Wouldn't make any sense to have one set of choice of law rules with regard to enforcement of arbitration agreements at the beginning of a case, and a different choice of law rule from considering recognition of awards with the same arbitration agreement at the end of the case, and therefore have imported the Article 5 choice of law rule into analysis at the beginning of the case in deciding whether to recognize an international arbitration agreement. But right off the bat, one has, by virtue of the uncertainty created by Articles 2 and 5 of the Convention, and to some extent Articles 8 and 34 and 36 of the Model Law, uncertainty about the basic rules of the game. And that uncertainty has been magnified, if you will, exacerbated, by the existence of different choice of law rules, different choice of law approaches in different contracting states. Different commentators other than myself have remarked on this. Piero Bernardini counted up three different choice of law approaches. Julian Liu found four. Mark Blessing, perhaps because he's Swiss and particularly meticulous, came up with nine. And we should all keep track by the time of my discussion today to see whether I'm more Swiss or more Italian or more something else. Whatever view one takes, Italian, English, or Swiss, though, it's clear that there are a multiplicity of choice of law rules for what, at the end of the day, oughtn't to be so complicated and oughtn't to be subject to such uncertainty. The whole point of international commercial arbitration, as I said, is to create an efficient, neutral, expert means of resolving disputes in a centralized forum, and in particular to avoid the sorts of jurisdictional and choice of law complexities that exist in national court litigation. That's why parties decide to do something other than litigate. They want an efficient, simple, enforceable means of resolving their disputes, and this existence of 3, 4, 9, however many different choice of law approaches to international arbitration agreements, ill serves that objective. Before I look at possible solutions for that problem, let's look a little more at the problem or the reality of multiple choice of law approaches and some of the difficulties that it creates. And in particular, what I'd like to do is go through the various choice of law approaches, the main choice of law approaches. Don't worry, I won't do 10, 9, or 10. But the main choice of law approaches that are used in different jurisdictions. The first is to apply the law of the arbitral seat. And so when a litigation arises in State A, State A doesn't necessarily apply its own law. Rather, it applies the law of the place where the parties agreed to arbitrate. Now, this choice of law approach has to some extent, the virtue of Article 5.1a and its default rule. Absent contrary agreement under Article 5.1a, the law of the place where the award is made, the arbitral seat, is to be applied. And in practice, that default rule would appear very frequently to be applicable, and that is because of our old friend, the separability presumption. Very seldom does one find in practice, indeed virtually never, occasionally sure, but in practice virtually never does one find a choice of law provision in the arbitration agreement specifically applicable to the arbitration agreement itself as distinguished from a general choice of law clause in the underlying contract. And so, at least potentially, if one takes the view that the arbitration agreement is a separable contract, a separable agreement, then the choice of law clause in the underlying contract applies to the substantive rights and obligations of that commercial contract and not to the separate arbitration agreement. And in those circumstances, according to this school of thought, one either applies the default rule. Since there's no choice of law by the parties, one applies the default rule in Article 5.1a, being the law of the arbitral seat. Some courts get to the same place through an implied choice analysis. They conclude that by citing the arbitration in a particular jurisdiction, the parties impliedly chose that jurisdiction's law to govern the arbitration agreement. And that analysis is to some extent supported by the notion that if you look at the separable arbitration agreement, the place to which it, with which it has the closest connection, the most real connection, is the arbitral seat. That's the place whose laws will govern the arbitral proceedings, where annulment will occur, and so forth. And so there's a very substantial body of analysis, body of authority, national courts and arbitral awards, that adopts that rule, the rule that the law of the arbitral seat will govern the substantive validity of the arbitration agreement. There's another second, and indeed more or less equally accepted approach, which is that the law governing the main contract, at least where the parties have agreed to a general choice of law clause, applies to the substantive validity of the arbitration agreement included in that contract. And this view says the world is rather simpler than this separability notion. When parties agree that this contract shall be governed by the law of state A, they don't mean this contract except not Article 12, which has the arbitration clause. They mean this whole contract, which includes the arbitration clause as well as everything else. And they occasionally will roll their eyes or something of the sort and say, what businessman ever would have thought, businessman or businesswoman ever would have thought that in choosing the law governing their contract, they weren't choosing the law governing the arbitration clause included in that contract. And this, as I say, is a line of choice of law analysis that also attracts substantial support. Both these two views encountered critiques as well, though. Both these two views. The first view, which was reflected in a variety of authorities, including a 1957 resolution by the International Law Institute that almost suggested that the law of the arbitral seat was mandatorily applicable. The law governing the main contract, which was adopted in a series of English decisions, the Sonatrach case, which some of you may be familiar with, the Svenska Petroleum Exploration case as well. Critiques arose of both these lines of analysis. It was suggested that the law governing the main contract was often closely connected to the arbitration, in particular, if, for example, one had an arbitration clause in a company charter, how could one attempt to detach the law governing the company charter from the law governing the arbitration agreement? Conversely, there were critiques of an automatic application of the law governing the main contract when parties had deliberately dissociated the arbitration from the home state of one of the two parties. And there were suggestions that both these two rules were in a sense, arbitrary, that they singled out one important aspect of the party's relationship and gave it preeminence over the others. And as a consequence, and this was consistent with more general choice of law thinking in the latter part of the last century, a third approach developed, and the third approach is variously called the closest connection or most significant relationship test. And the thought on this was, well, rather than have a black and white rule that it's always the arbitral seat, that it's always the law governing the underlying contract, we'll have a more nuanced, a more sensitive, a more flexible approach that will look to which jurisdiction the arbitration agreement has its most real, its most close, its most significant connection. And that was fashionable at the time. The Rome Convention, Rome I Regulation, the American Law Institute, the ALI's restatement on conflicts of law in Section 187, adopted that rule generally and then applied it specifically in Section 218. And a number of national courts and arbitral awards followed suit. And in some level, that had a certain attraction to it. One can't disagree too vigorously with an analysis that is flexible and nuanced and sensitive. But the reality is that there were very serious problems underneath the surface of that analysis as well when one thinks about it for a moment. And the reason is that at the end of the day, a closest connection analysis comes down to choosing between the first two alternatives that we've already talked about. It comes down to choosing between either the law of the arbitral seat or the law of the main contract. And courts that attempted, arbitral tribunals that attempted to apply this analysis would go through a recitation of various factors and connecting factors in an effort to choose one or the other of these two possible jurisdictions and come away with what I think in the eyes of most readers would be a fairly unprincipled and arbitrary choice of one as opposed to the other. And in that sense, one hadn't really moved much past the previous state of affairs where one picked either the law of the arbitral seat or the law of the main contract, except that one had created ex ante uncertainty as to which of those two routes you were going to follow. And so in a sense, you had the worst of both worlds. You had an unprincipled and arbitrary choice with a whole lot of uncertainty attending that choice at the front end. And so in reaction to that, yet additional approaches, choice of law approaches, were adopted. One was the so-called cumulative approach. And this is sort of what you do when all else fails with your kids. You park them in front of the video. The cumulative approach said, essentially, you look at every possible approach, and if the arbitration agreement is valid under the law of the arbitral seat and the law governing the main contract and perhaps the law of the place where the contract's being performed and perhaps the law of where the parties have their residences, then you will give effect to the agreement. And in a sense, this was a sort of false conflicts approach. If all the potentially applicable national laws would uphold the arbitration agreement, then the cumulative approach made perfect sense in a way. You didn't really need it, but it made perfect sense. The difficulty was when, and this is the only reason one really has choice of law analysis, is when the potentially applicable laws pointed in different directions. When one law, which had a connection to the arbitration agreement, would uphold the agreement, and another law, also connected to the agreement, would not do so. And in that circumstance, the cumulative approach was completely useless. It provided no way to distinguish between one potentially applicable law and another. Now, I won't spend much time on other possible approaches. Those approaches included applying the law of one of the arbitrators. It didn't really make sense in a three-person tribunal, but applying the law of the arbitrator's residence on some sort of implied choice theory, applying the law that's sometimes referred to as lex mercatoria, and applying and taking other even more esoteric choice of law approaches. And that, in a sense, is where we are at present. Where we are at present is that there's a multiplicity of different approaches to the law governing the arbitration, the substantive validity of the arbitration agreement, and no clear way to choose between those approaches. And what I'd like to do now, having laid out the past and the present, is turn to the future. And what I'd like to suggest is that there is a principled and desirable approach towards this choice of law question, and that is the so-called validation principle. A validation principle, in a sense, is the mirror image of the cumulative choice of law approach. The validation principle would say that if the International Arbitration Agreement is substantively valid under any of the laws that might potentially be applicable to it, then its validity will be upheld even if it's not valid under one of the other or several of the other potentially applicable choices of law. And the reasoning behind this approach is twofold. The reasoning, firstly, is that it best accomplishes the parties' objectives, that it best accomplishes their aim of an efficient, neutral means of resolving commercial disputes without the jurisdictional and choice of law complexities that one encounters in national court litigation. And secondly, that that is just what the New York Convention and the model law contemplate, and we'll say a word about the text of those instruments in explaining that conclusion. I should say that there are movements in the direction of a validation principle in some jurisdictions. Switzerland was early off the mark. It adopted in the Swiss law and private international law, Article 178, subparagraph 2, a validation principle, which provided that the arbitration agreement would be valid if it were valid under the laws of any of the underlying contract, the law governing the party's arbitration agreement as chosen by the parties, and finally, Swiss law. It was not a sort of full-bore validation principle of the sort that I've described, but it was a validation principle of sorts. Spain, Algeria, a couple other jurisdictions have followed suit. Some national court decisions, a decision in Austria, have adopted similar analysis, as have arbitral awards. And part of the reason for this is a dissatisfaction with the closest connection and most significant relationship standard. One of the interesting things is when you look, for example, at English cases, there was, as I mentioned, an early line of, indeed not so early, a line of authority that ended about 10, 15 years ago, in which English courts held that the arbitration agreement was governed by the law governing the main contract, at least where the parties had chosen that law. And then about 10 years ago, English courts flipped and adopted a rule that, in principle, the law of the arbitral seat would govern the arbitration agreement on the theory that that was an implied choice. And the English courts were able, in the space of 20 years, to adopt two almost completely opposed views of which of the two main connecting factors ought to apply. The English courts weren't alone in doing this. U.S. courts, when you look at Court of Appeals decisions, do exactly the same thing. Some will apply the law of the arbitral seat, some the law of the main contract, and all, just like commentators, are equally passionate in their chosen factor. And the reality is it makes very little sense to apply what I would suggest is an arbitrary preference for one or the other of those two connecting factors, when what one ought to look at is the party's real intentions and objectives. And their real intentions and objectives are, when they agree to a separable arbitration agreement, to create, as I've said previously, an efficient and enforceable means to resolve their dispute in an enforceable fashion. And I'd like to go back to an early English decision, which I think expresses this rationale quite well. It's a House of Lords decision from 1894. The separability presumption hadn't even surfaced as such at that time. It's a delightful case between a company called Hamlin and Company and Talisker Distillery. Every time I go through the duty-free stores, I think of this case. And it involved a contract entirely to be performed in Scotland, except the contract had in it an agreement to arbitrate on the Corn Exchange in London in, quote, the usual fashion. Under Scots law, the arbitration agreement was invalid because it didn't name the arbitrators, one of the bad old anti-arbitration rules that I referred to previously. Under English law, the arbitration agreement, you guessed it, is valid. And so there was a choice of law question. Lord Ashbourne upheld the arbitration agreement. Perhaps he upheld it in part because of a homing instinct. Judges do that. But he also upheld it on a rationale that I think has enduring significance even today. He upheld it on the basis that the parties had negotiated this agreement to arbitrate. They'd included it in their contract. And were it to be subjected to Scots law, it would be, in his words, mere waste paper. And he said elsewhere that if you applied Scots law to the agreement, it would mutilate it. And that ultimately, in order to effectuate the party's intentions here, one should apply English law. And I would suggest that that reasoning applies equally today and equally under the New York Convention, that when parties include an agreement to arbitrate in an international commercial contract, they don't think about the separability presumption, and they don't think about all the 10, 9, 4, 3 choice of law theories that I've laid out for you and that Professors Bernardini, Liu, and Blessing have explained so carefully. What they think about is a means to efficiently resolve their disputes, and therefore, and that's the important bit, therefore their implied choice. Their implied choice is a validation principle. That validation principle calls for application of the national law that will give effect to their agreement, rather than treating their agreement, their arbitration agreement, as mere waste paper. And when one looks at the text of the New York Convention and also the model law, one gets to exactly the same place. Remember, Article 5.1a provides for, in the first instance, application of the law to which the parties have subjected the arbitration agreement, and only failing an indication thereon, the law of the arbitral seat. And I would suggest that the party's implied choice in that analysis is consistent with what Lord Ashbourne said 130 years ago or so, a validation principle, and it is that which the New York Convention can be fairly read to require, and that the same result comes out of Article 2.1 when it calls on, when it requires contracting states to recognize agreements to arbitrate. That recognition includes all the material terms of agreements to arbitrate, including their implied terms and including the party's implied choice of the validation principle. And so all of those, all that reasoning would point towards a future in which rather than 10 or a multiplicity of applicable rules governing substantive validity of arbitration agreements, one would have an international rule, a validation principle that would give effect to the arbitration agreement so long as that agreement would be valid under any of the jurisdictions having a connection to the agreement. Now, I actually truncated my discussion of the various choice of law rules approaches that the choice of law approaches that are applicable to arbitration agreements. And I want to take us back for a moment to the present again, because I left out two choice of law approaches which it is important to talk about. And these two approaches arose in substantial part because of the frustration that existed with most significant relationship and closest connection standard. These two approaches were, firstly, and I think given that this is a Brierley lecture, it's particularly appropriate that the two jurisdictions I'm going to talk about are a civil law and a common law jurisdiction. The first was the approach of French courts, which, starting with a landmark decision called Dalico some 40 years ago, held that the arbitration agreement was autonomous, separable in a sense, autonomous, but not just from the underlying contract, instead also from the national legal system, which would otherwise apply. And as a consequence, the substantive validity of the arbitration agreement was governed by international, what the French courts called international arbitration law. And that law had substantive contract law principles in it which gave effect to what the court called the common intention of the parties. And in a sense, the French courts jumped over, avoided the need for the choice of law analysis that had emerged in the other examples that I've described, and contemplated that arbitration agreements would be governed, international arbitration agreements would be governed entirely by substantive principles of international law. At the same time, and somewhat ironically, U.S. courts adopted a similar approach. U.S. courts did not adopt a sort of full-scale application of international substantive contract law rules to arbitration agreements, but they did read the New York Convention, and in particular Articles 2, 1, and 2, 3, as imposing international limitations on the substantive rules that contracting states could apply to international arbitration agreements. And in particular, they read Article 2 as imposing a rule of non-discrimination. What that meant was that only national laws which treated international arbitration agreements like other contracts and like other arbitration agreements would be applied to international arbitration agreements. So the basic premise was you could apply national law, but with an international limitation that got rid of discriminatory or idiosyncratic national rules. And for example, U.S. courts refused to apply an Italian rule, notwithstanding that the arbitration was seated in Italy, an Italian rule that forbid even numbers of arbitrators. They refused to apply a rule of unconscionability that seemed to be tilted against arbitration agreements and so forth. But the essential approach was, in concept, broadly similar to that in France. And what I'd like to do is move from that present to a discussion about the future and, in a sense, an evaluation of those two approaches, and also to close out my remarks, an explanation of how those two approaches fit with the validation principle. What I'd like to suggest is that the French approach, although revolutionary in a sense and admirable, has a lot of work to do in the sense that it posits an existing body of substantive international arbitration law governing the validity of the arbitration agreement. That would mean a body of law governing everything from duress to unconscionability to impossibility to mistake to fraud and so forth. I think that is, to use the phrase of the day, a big ask. It's not so easy to see where that substantive body of international arbitration law comes from, where have states consented to it. It's not very easy to see what its substance is. I think it's, in truth, a lot easier today than it was perhaps 10 years ago. And that's not necessarily because of developments in the world of international commercial arbitration, but rather developments in the world of international investment arbitration, where there is an increasingly nuanced and detailed body of law governing international investment arbitration agreements in both bilateral investment treaties and otherwise. And as that body develops texture, if you will, depth, it at least arguably could provide a source of the rules for international commercial arbitration agreements. How exactly one connects that body of rules designed for investment arbitration to international commercial arbitration agreements, I think, is more challenging. And I think the more secure, the more solidly grounded in existing legal instruments approach is that of the U.S. courts and the non-discrimination principle, which recognizes, as indeed Article 5.1a recognizes, that national law does have some application to arbitration agreements, but equally recognizes that Article 2, which requires in Article 2.1 that states recognize international arbitration agreements, that principle can't be given force without such a rule of non-discrimination. When Article 2.1 and 2.3 talk about arbitration agreements and require states to enforce arbitration agreements except where they're null and void, inoperable, or incapable of being performed, they didn't intend states to be able to deny recognition to such agreements on the grounds that they're null and void simply in their own discretion or without limitation. There must be some notion of an international limitation in Article 2 itself, in that non-discrimination principle that some U.S. courts have identified, I would suggest, is a fairly useful concept in that regard. What this would give us then, turning almost to my conclusion, what this would give us then would be, instead of the multiplicity of existing choice of law approaches, a two-part rule, both parts grounded in the New York Convention and therefore mandatorily applicable on all 149 contracting parties. all 149 contracting states, A, a validation principle, meaning that in order to give effect to Articles 2 and 5, a state, a contracting state, must give effect to arbitration agreements if they'd be valid under any state with a connection to that agreement. And secondly, a non-discrimination rule that whatever national law applies to the arbitration agreement knocks out certain discriminatory or idiosyncratic provisions of that law. I would suggest that this is much better place to be than the current choice of law conclusion. I would suggest that it is consistent with parties' objectives in agreeing to arbitrate, which, I'll say it just one more time, is to adopt a neutral, expert, efficient means of resolving their disputes without choice of law and jurisdictional complexities of litigation. And finally, that it's consistent with the 149 contracting states that agreed to the New York Convention, which was to encourage the enforcement and use of international arbitration agreements. Now, that was my conclusion, but my postscript is I didn't tell you, I didn't talk to you about formal validity, capacity, or non-arbitrability, but similar analysis applies in each of those contexts and supports the analysis that one can adopt for substantive validity of arbitration agreements. Articles 2.1 and 2.2, with respect to form requirements, have a blend of international maximum standard and national law rules. Capacity has an international choice of law rule in Article 5.1a, but use of national law rules, and non-arbitrability has an international exception, which I would suggest places some limits on national law definitions of non-arbitrability. All of those, though, are topics for future Brierley lectures, and I'm sure that I've gone over my allotted time. I apologize for that, and I thank you again for the very kind invitation.
Actually, I don't. I'm an adherent to the school of KISS, keep it simple, stupid, which is what my associates usually say to me. I find efforts to include choice of law clauses in arbitration agreements more often likely to boomerang than to produce happy results. Sometimes if you have a standalone arbitration agreement, which, you know, for example, covers a large project with multiple contracts and naturally has in it a choice of law clause, you can include that. But in general, and I know this is terribly unimaginative, in general, I favor using tested institutional arbitration clauses and varying from their text as little as possible.
But why not add on to a validity presumption?
That's the benefit of Q&A. That's certainly an idea that one could pursue. I don't see any immediate reasons not to. I do have to say that I to some extent worry about how odd bits of arbitration clauses that courts or arbitrators aren't used to seeing get treated in those proceedings. All that said, certainly language that underscores the party's desire that the arbitration agreement be valid, that it be upheld, would be a constructive addition.
Thank you very much, Gary, for coming in. Thank you for your masterful lecture. I have three questions, but I'll let you decide if you want to answer only one or two questions. The first one is theoretical. When I was listening to you, I was thinking that in many ways, you are adopting the perspective of the national judge considering these questions. But issues of applicable law arise also from the perspective of an arbitrary investigative with a jurisdictional objection. And there's an interesting theoretical question that arises when you look at things from that perspective, which is where does the relevant choice of law come from? From the arbitrator's point of view. A big question. I wonder if you want to touch on that, but I'm very interested in your views on it, even though your views on this.
Am I allowed to take the three questions? I'm slightly. I belong to the school that, and this is to some extent similar to my approach towards the relationship between Articles 2 and 5 of the New York Convention, which is that they should be read systematically and as part of a cohesive whole. I similarly belong to the school of thought that arbitrators also are bound by the New York Convention. They're not contracting states, they're not contracting parties, but they are, as part of their adjudicative mission, required to apply law, the applicable law, to an arbitration agreement in 149 jurisdictions around the world as the New York Convention. Arbitrators not only should but must apply the same rules that will ultimately be applicable in national courts, either in agreement enforcement proceedings or award annulment and recognition proceedings. That means the New York Convention. And therefore, and amongst the authorities that I tried to refer to were arbitral awards in addressing the validation principle and indeed the other choice of law rules. There are choice of law questions about what law an arbitral tribunal should apply. I think in many ways they're the same choice of law questions that a national court must apply. Does one apply the law governing the main contract? Does one apply the law of the arbitral seat? The conclusions that I have drawn about a validation principle and the international standard of non-discrimination apply equally to the arbitral tribunal.
And on that validation, second question, on that validation principle, what would you do with a case where one of the legal orders connected to the dispute would validate the agreement, but in an internationally unacceptable manner? Example, the legal order would extend the arbitration agreement to a non-signatory in a way that clearly disregards the separate legal personality of different corporate entities in the corporate group. Where does that, surely that there must be some sort of limitations to the validation principle of thinking. So where is the check? How do you operate a check on to deal with those cases?
That's a very good question. I confine my comments to the substantive validity of the arbitration agreement. And the status of non-signatories raises a challenging question of characterization. It's not clear at all to me that non-signatory status is part of the substantive validity of the contract. And I do think that one has to give very careful consideration to exactly the point that you made. It's equally not entirely clear to me that the validation principle applies in the same manner to non-signatory questions. The honest truth is I haven't figured out the answer yet. but it's not meant to be covered in the remarks that I made.
Can we see if there's any other questions before we let Frederick ask his third question? Even though the good question, obviously.
Third time's a charm.
That's it? Well,
how do you make the validation principle fit with the New York Convention and the model of law? Let's say we want to argue this before a national judge today who's not a specialist in international arbitration. Here she looks at the New York Convention. It says, party's choice, default rule, choice of C, and you appear before him or her with this validation principle. Is the best argument an implied choice logic to make it fit with the first limb of Article 5?
Yeah.
Is that the best way to pitch it, or do you want to take the judge outside the New York Convention framework for it?
Well, I guess I would argue it in two steps. I would
I would rely on both the convention and national law. The convention is a kind of, if you will, threat, in the sense that this is an international obligation, if you accept my analysis. I should say that my analysis, the validation principle, draws support from both Article 5.1a and Article 2 on the theory that Article 2.1 requires contracting states to recognize agreements to arbitrate, and that includes, naturally, all material terms of agreements to arbitrate, implied terms and express terms. Among the implied terms is the validation principle. I would at the same time, though, obviously try to ground this as firmly as possible in national law, so as to avoid confronting the judge with an international obligation that might be inconsistent with national law. I think the model law enables essentially the same argument that I've laid out under the convention. I think one can also draw on use of the validation principle in other settings, and would certainly do that in particular national legal systems. The validation principle, one finds examples of it in lots of different contexts, and I would think that using those in a national law system would be a sensible advocacy technique. I also think it's important, again, in thinking about whether it makes sense or how persuasive it is to apply a validation principle to arbitration agreements, to focus on the particular character of arbitration agreements. It's a case where you do virtually never have an express choice, and the idea that business people would have thought about what law to apply to this agreement, I think, is quite far-fetched. In those circumstances, I think the concept that, you know, you have an agreement here whose only obligations are, the only obligations in this agreement essentially are, we're going to arbitrate with each other. The notion that that should be invalidated through choice of law rules seems to me equally far-fetched.
Thank you very much.
I mean, you talked about the keep it simple method of not having a specific choice of law applicable to the arbitration agreement itself. Is how would your validation principle interplay, assuming that one had an overly eager business person or counsel who went ahead and added a specific choice of law clause to the arbitration agreement that turns out to invalidate it? Would it just
I think it's interesting. I mean, that's a tough case in which to argue that there should be a validation principle based on some sort of implied choice. Note that the Swiss have, if you will, bitten the theoretical bullet on that. And under the Swiss law and private international law, the parties can pick a law applicable to their arbitration agreement that will specifically invalidate it, and Swiss courts will nonetheless uphold the agreement if it's valid under Swiss law or the law applicable to the main contract. The theory, I guess, I mean, legislatures don't really need a theory, but they're different from arbitrators and judges. We need theories and reasons. Legislatures don't, but I think the theory behind it is that the party's authentic choice, the party's real choice, wasn't the mistake that they made in picking a law that would invalidate their arbitration agreement, but really to give effect to the agreement. That's a hard argument. I think there's actually some force to it in the real world, but one can imagine, especially national judges, not being particularly excited about it.
You can also imagine an implied assumption that maybe one party was taking advantage of the other, in a sense that a realistic.
That's possible, or some theory of mistake. You could also imagine.
Just to play devil's advocate for a minute, what do you think, if you were party trying to get out of the arbitration clause, would be a strong argument against the validation?
I think the principal argument would be that one should pay attention to the text of Article 5.1a on the one hand, if one's going to
to look to the convention for choice of law rules or to, if you will, traditional orthodox, the present day choice of law rules in individual national jurisdictions, that those choice of law rules historically have been focused on the law of a particular national jurisdiction. Most choice of law rules do that, select the law of a particular jurisdiction based on connecting factors, and that absent some sort of legislative guidance not present in the text of the convention or the model law, one shouldn't depart from that orthodoxy. To my argument that one can say that the validation principle is an implied choice of the parties, one could say that's, you know, that's creative. An academic might come up with that, but how many businessmen would ever really imagine that they were impliedly choosing a validation principle, which you have to search through indices in conflicts treatises to find? In truth, I think although rhetorically cute, that, you know, that response doesn't actually get to the substance of the validation principle, which is when you look at the real commercial intentions and objectives of business parties and to some extent states in agreeing to these very peculiar creatures, arbitration agreements, I think the validation principle actually does capture their intentions in a pretty faithful and authentic way.
Maybe a question or a comment. Martin Balasek and Norfolk Fulbright. On this validation notion, doesn't it prove too much in the sense that agreements are invalidated under many circumstances, and presumably the parties that are in the agreement didn't want their agreement to be invalidated. So why is it that we give the arbitration clause such a special status when it comes to a potential public policy concern of a particular jurisdiction that doesn't want to enforce its substantive terms in the way that they've been drafted? I mean, wouldn't a business person whose agreement is invalidated for competition reasons say, well, we clearly intended this agreement to be binding, and therefore we would like the law that validates it to apply? And the jurisdiction enforcing would say, well, no, here we have a public policy concern that it's anti-competitive, so we won't enforce it. Why wouldn't public policy concerns of a potentially applicable jurisdiction that invalidates the agreement not have the force to counter the validation principle in the same way?
Well, as you remember, what I excluded from my talk was a non-arbitrability principle, and said that would be a subject for another talk. The convention clearly does recognize it, that contracting states can, applying their own law, and it has in it a choice of law rule in that respect in Article 5.2a, not 5.1a, but 5.2a, permits states to define certain categories of disputes as non-arbitrable, and one certainly has to take that possibility into account. As I mentioned, I think there are international limitations on that as well. I don't think that a similar analysis applies, though, outside the public policy context. I think that where you're dealing with questions of contract law rules of duress or unconscionability or mistake or fraud and the like, that the validation principle really does capture the intentions of the parties and the commitments of contracting states under the New York Convention to give effect to those intentions, notwithstanding particular national law rules.
I think we have time for one last intervention. It's following a little bit on the same lines, but you didn't mention whether the Talisker case, you said House of Lords, but I'm assuming that it was House of Lords sitting on appeal from an English decision, not a Scots decision.
I'm pretty sure it was a Scots decision, actually.
Okay, because then that changes everything in a way, because I would have assumed that the reaction of the court might have been different if it was the law of the forum that was declaring the clause to be invalid as opposed to a foreign law. So it is, to me, a significant question whether it was sitting in on appeal from a Scottish court or not. Do you think that makes any difference? Or is that
Let's try to play it through. In the one instance, you would have a Scots court invalidating the clause and permitting, and I'm pretty sure this is what happened, and permitting a Scots litigation to go forward notwithstanding the clause. And in that instance, the English court said, no, you would be by applying Scots law, the law of the judicial enforcement forum, be denying effect to the arbitration agreement. Suppose it was different. Suppose the English court, the English High Court, the English Court of Appeal, had applied Scots law and concluded that, because fairly clearly the arbitration agreement didn't satisfy the requirements of Scots law, that the agreement was invalid, and therefore you wouldn't have an arbitration in England. I don't see how the analysis should be any different in that circumstance.
I just thought that perhaps the public policy argument would be more forceful if the only invalidating law was the law of the forum itself. So it would be more difficult for that court to accept to declare the validity of the clause when it was going against its, even particularly if it was not idiosyncratic, so your non-discrimination rule. Nevertheless, I think your point about the fact that it exists in other areas, for example, choice of law for formal validity of contract follows the validation rule. So there certainly is some precedent for following that approach. Well, I'm afraid we have to close up.
A really easy one.
Okay.
Very straightforward.
Okay.
I'm wondering if there can be a prima facie review of an arbitration agreement and apply the
It's a timely question here in Canada, I guess. I don't see why not. I would have thought that in most instances, a genuine prima facie review analysis would not get one deeply into the intricacies of doctrines of mistake or unconscionability or impossibility of the sort that I've discussed. Nonetheless, at least in principle, in deciding on the substantive validity of an arbitration agreement, which is what prima facie review on some level is directed towards, one ought to know what laws one is applying. And therefore, I don't see any difficulty in it. A court asked to perform a prima facie review would inquire what law prima facie is applicable. The validation principle would guide its analysis. It would then, in the context of that legal order, look to whether or not there was a prima facie case that the arbitration agreement was substantively valid. It would, in many cases, I think, uphold that without much further ado, but I think the two would fit together quite consistently.
Short question, but most complex answer. So it's left to me to thank you on all of our behalf, a small token of our appreciation.
Thank you.
Please remember to give your form back at the exit, and I'd invite Metro Woods to send us off to the next part of the
First of all, it's an honor for our firm to be associated with the Squire Lee Memorial Lectures. It gives us a chance to offer from the wonderful comments that we heard tonight. I also had a thought listening to Andrea's introduction to the start for Gary, and her reference to both John Briarly and Khani Dajid, that I had the privilege of being a student of both John Briarly and Khani Dajid. And thinking specifically of Khani Dajid, I can see myself sitting at his house, which was very close to the foot of Mont Saint-Foy, which is charming white, having a wonderful key. And the band on that we have tonight, unfortunately, I don't think we have any Pierre, but you're all invited to join us in the action for President Dunn. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know what's in it.